Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work, enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikitas.
Hello, and thanks so much for joining us for episode 314 with Laura Vanderkam. I think you'll really love this conversation. If you ever feel busy, like there's just too much to do and you just don't have any time, well, Laura takes direct aim at this ubiquitous problem and has some real research-based solutions and suggestions, best practices to share for how to deal with it and just feel amazing, like you got all the time in the world. Wouldn't that be refreshing? Well, it is possible. So you'll learn, one, how those who feel their time is vast spend their day. Two, how to draw more energy by acknowledging the three selves. And three, how to stretch your experience of time. So if you'd like to take a look at the show notes or the transcript or the links to items that we've referenced, it's over at awesomeatyourjob.com/F314. And while at awesomeatyourjob.com, I encourage you to check out some of our cool stuff. One cool way to save time is to check out the 10 Days to Winning at Work email course. So this has 10 bite-sized tidbits excerpted from my enhanced thinking and collaboration training programs that have been shown to slash over 80 minutes of waste out of each professional's work week. So I hope that works for you. And that's over at awesomeatyourjob.com. And it's free. Now here's Laura's story. Laura is the author of several time management and productivity books, like Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. I Know How She Does It, How Successful Women Make the Most of Their Time, and What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast, and 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think. Laura's work has appeared in publications including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, City Journal, Fortune, and Fast Company. She's appeared on numerous television programs, radio segments, and has spoken about time and productivity to audiences of all sizes. Her TED Talk, How to Gain Control of Your Time, has been viewed more than 5 million times. She is the co-host with Sarah Hart Unger of the podcast Best of Both Worlds. Here is Laura. Laura, thanks so much for joining us here on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, I want to hear about the story behind you singing at Carnegie Hall.
Yes, I included that as my odd thing about me. So I've sung for many years in various choirs, and I lived in New York for quite a while. And one of the things that is sometimes an opportunity is that a choir might do a show in Carnegie Hall. I mean, either an orchestra needs a choir for a bit, or a singer needs a backup, or sometimes, you know, choirs will rent it out. And so I've had a couple of those different experiences where I've been able to sing in that amazing space. So,
oh, multiple kind of times. Excellent.
Yeah. So it's really about proximity and then also taking up these opportunities. It's a beautiful place to sing.
And I have to ask, it's so corny, but did you ever ask anyone for directions to Carnegie Hall, and did you get the old joke response?
I believe that I have, in the sense of I would get into a cab and, you know, say, please take me to Carnegie Hall, and then somebody guffaws. But it's the same thing. You know, you live in New York for a while. These things that are sort of cultural touchstones elsewhere, you realize are not necessarily. I mean, so I think I used to think of like Broadway. Oh, Broadway is this mythical place, you know. Then I realize it's a street, and the district is named for a street. And so it's more that certain theaters are associated with being high end, you know, first run plays and all that. And so those are considered being on Broadway, but it's not like they're only on Broadway. Mm-hmm. various streets around there as well. So yeah, you learn these things.
So the cab driver didn't say, well, the only way to get there is practice.
Well, and also that I'll drive you there and kind of
Okay, understood. Established. Well, tell us about your latest book. You've got several, and this is your latest. It's called Off the Clock. What's the big idea here?
Well, Off the Clock is about how to feel less busy while getting more done. And in essence, it's about how some people who have a lot going on in their lives still have this sense of time freedom. They feel like they do have time for the things they want to do. They feel like time is expansive, that it's not slipping away from them, that it feels good. And so I wanted to learn these people's secrets. You know, what are they doing with their lives? What are they doing with their hours? And what can the rest of us learn from that?
That's so fascinating. And so You use the term a lot, time perception. Can you sort of define that in terms of how you think about it, what it looks, sounds, feels like, as well as how you defined it precisely in your research?
So time perception is just what it sounds like, how we perceive time. And time obviously keeps moving along at the same rate, regardless, 24 hours a day, 168 hours a week. But you think about different times of our life feel very different. Maybe like a week of summer camp when you were 12 felt very, very long. Whereas for most people as adults this past week, probably didn't feel that big for you. I mean, you may have very few memories of the past week of what makes it stand out for you more than anything else. But it's also about, you know, whether you feel like you have the time for the things that you want to do, like whether you feel in control of your time, whether you feel present or distracted, whether you simultaneously feel like time is rushing by too quickly at times, and that also you spend a lot of time wishing minutes away. That's an unfortunate aspect of time perception. Many people are sitting there in a boring meeting being like, I really wish it was 11 o'clock already. Time slipping from one side of the hourglass to the other, and sometimes we're trying to shove it along even more quickly. So time perception in my research, though, had a more specific definition. I recruited for Off the Clock 900 people who had full-time jobs and who also had families to track their time for a day. March 27, 2017 was the day. They recorded what they were doing on that day and then answered various questions about how they felt about their time. And these were various questions like, you know, yesterday I generally felt present rather than distracted, or yesterday I generally felt I had enough time for the things I wanted to do. And also questions about their life in general. Broadly, I have enough time for the things I want to do. I spend time in ways that make me happy. Various questions like this. People get scores. They answer on these from strongly disagree to strongly agree. You know, assign those a 1 through 7 point scale. And so the people with the high time perception scores were the ones who strongly agreed with various statements of time abundance like that. That they felt like they had enough time for the things they wanted to do. People with low perception scores felt the opposite. And so then I could compare the schedules of people who had high time perception scores and people who had low time perception scores and see how their lives were actually different.
Well, so what's so intriguing there is it sounds like for the most, more or less, the amount of actual quote unquote free time that they had was probably somewhat comparable. Like they do have full-time jobs and they do have children and spouses to tend to. So they're sort of in a similar band there. And yet I'd like to get a sense from you just how much of a spread was there between their time perception. So we got a 1 to 7. I mean, did we get the full gamut there? We got some full-blown yeah. ones and full-blown sevens?
Much, yeah, people who are down in the, you know, close to the single digit, probably not exactly in the single digit. With anything like this, very few people put ones or sevens on everything. That's one of the reasons we give so many options. In general, most people like to be in the middle. But there's, you know, giving people 7 allows them to have the degrees within that. So people will give you a 2 or 3 answer, or they will give you a 5 or 6. And those are different. Most people won't say a 1 or 7 regardless. But there were people who felt pretty bad about their time. And then there were people who felt pretty awesome about it too. And they were all sort of objectively the same amount of busyness. You know, it was interesting to see what wasn't different. Pretty much everyone in the sample worked somewhere between 7 and 9 hours on that March Monday, which makes sense. You know, they all have full-time jobs. That's pretty much what a full-time job means. And, you know, all had various family obligations and such. So yeah, we're not talking a huge range in terms of what time was available. So some of the differences were really in how they spent that discretionary time. So people who felt like they had a lot of time, for instance, were more likely to do what I kind of consider higher quality leisure activities, things like actively getting together with family or friends, reading, exercise, doing various what I call sort of like memorable activities. They had little adventures even in their evenings, more interesting than one might think for a Monday night. Whereas the people who had low time perception scores were more likely to spend a big chunk of that time watching TV or being on social media or other such electronic ways of spending time.
That's so fascinating because, wow, we do have the same hours in the day, just sort of the nature of the planet and the sun and how that works. And yet the perceptions are vastly different. And you could find that link there between their perception and the actual activities that they were engaged in. So it sounds like it wasn't so much that the folks were, you know, reading or getting together with friends for more leisure hours than those who were on social media or TV hours.
No, I mean, the times themselves were not appreciably different. Because again, yes, we all have 24 hours in a day. But it's just what you choose to do with this time that you do have available to you. I mean, if you think about the time before you go to bed, many adults, even those who are raising children, have some quantity of leisure time before they go to bed in the evening. What do you choose to do with it? And it turns out that if you spend that time like on Facebook looking at photos of people you didn't like in high school anyway, you feel like you have less time than if you spend that time actually talking with your spouse or calling a friend or reading a book. That those are all sort of activities that make you feel like I'm the kind of person who has the time to do these things. And that's where the high time perception comes from.
Fascinating. And can you share a little bit in terms of, you know, it certainly sounds more pleasant to operate in a world in which you perceive that you have enough time, but could you maybe unpack that all the further in terms of what are the advantages of having a high time perception?
Well, in general, you'll probably be happier because feeling rushed and harried is obviously associated with high levels of stress, and that's no fun for anyone. But it's also, you know, about being effective, because when you feel more in control of your time, then you're more likely to spend it in ways that are meaningful for you. So, you know, the people who felt like they generally had time for the things that they want to do, this is not particularly surprising, but they were highly likely to report that they had made progress on personal or professional goals in the previous 24 hours. So when you feel like you have enough time, you feel like you can allocate it to things that matter to you. And so that's what people were doing. Whereas when you feel like time is just getting away from you, like you have no grasp on time, then you don't feel in a powerful enough position to allocate those hours to the things that are important to you. You sort of just react to what's coming in.
Well, also, it's intriguing the specific uses of time, what folks were doing and how that played an impact or a role. I guess I'm wondering, you know, how does one cross the chasm there if you have a low time perception and you're feeling like, oh my gosh, I don't have enough hours in the day to handle everything, to becoming one of those joyous folk who think that they've got plenty of time?
Yeah, well, that's the goal of a self-help book. And those are the strategies I try to share in this book. What were these people doing differently? Because it's one thing to tell you that, yes, some people perceive time differently than others, but that's somewhat not helpful for anyone who would like to live a fulfilling and rewarding life. So there are seven strategies that I identified that people with high time perception scores were more likely to use. I mean, just a few of them, though, just, you know, if people are thinking about this, like, what can I do more immediately? One thing is figure out where your time is actually going. And I know that sounds like maybe something people don't really want to do, keeping track of your time is one of the best ways to see, well, here's where it's actually going. And then you can ask, do I like this? Do I not like this? And being able to make that decision with good data allows you to make changes in a way that's more effective than if you're just sort of operating from various stories like, oh, I have no time for anything. Well, if you are telling yourself you have no time for anything, it's hard to do anything about that. But if you track your time and say, oh, well, I see that I was watching TV for 2 hours in the evening and I keep telling myself I'd like to read more. Maybe I could read for an hour and then turn on the TV. Wow, well, that's an interesting idea. And then it turns out you will probably feel like you have more time if you are willing to make a change like that. You know, one other finding that was somewhat surprising, but was definitely there, was that the people with the highest time perception scores were highly likely to do kind of interesting and out of the ordinary things, even though this was a very normal March Monday that they were recording. One person who responded to my survey had actually gone to salsa dancing lessons. That was on her time log for the evening. Somebody else went to like a big band concert on this Monday evening. But there's even more, you know, pedestrian stuff like going to a movie on Monday night or meeting a friend for a drink or taking the family to the park after dinner instead of sitting around watching TV. So, you know, choosing to do interesting things with your time makes you feel like you're the kind of person who does interesting things with his or her time. And again, that's a thing that makes you feel in control, makes you feel like you are in a good place with this and, you know, can expand your experience of time.
Well, I guess where I think maybe the rubber meets the road in terms of, am I going to watch TV or am I going to read a book? Am I going to browse social media or am I going to get together with a friend? I think in those moments is, well, one, I guess it's just kind of planning ahead in terms of you have a plan and you're going to meet somebody. But I think the other one is often just, that just seems like so much work. You know, I'd be so exhausted to change and leave the house and do this because I've just been so, you know, beat down or whatever. So it seems like the energy factor is huge in terms of what do folks think they can even handle, you know, taking on and doing, say, on a Monday evening. So do you address that perspective?
I do. And I think what you need to realize with that energy question is that the self has, please stick with me, like people are going to turn off the podcast here, but I think this is an interesting point. The self, various psychologists have looked at this behavioral thing, that is really three selves. There's the part of you that is thinking forward to the future, so the anticipating self, the experiencing self, which is what you are feeling in the here and now, you know, going through life, and then the remembering self, which is the part that is thinking back to things you have done in the past. And these are all three part of us. But the issue, and I quote this philosopher saying this, is that we pamper the present like a spoiled child. We pay very much attention to our experiencing self, which makes sense. It's how we're going through life. But it's really only one actor in what should be a three actor play. Like our anticipating self and our remembering selves are the ones who want us to go to salsa dancing lessons on a Monday night because it sounds awesome. And when we get back, we'll be really happy we did it. Like nobody ever exercises and like, gosh, that was a horrible idea. Like it feels great once you do it, right? You know, and meeting your friends at the class, hearing the great music, like it's going to be awesome. But you have to get yourself in the car and go do it. And that's when your experiencing self throws this temper tantrum, like, no, I don't want to. So what you really have to do is this idea of just plan it in, do it anyway. Like you will draw energy from meaningful things. If you are not, you know, completely and totally exhausted, like you have some energy, right? Like you could maybe, you know, walk out to your front door or something as opposed to being like just completely passed out on the couch. Like if you could get yourself that far, like probably you could make yourself do it. And if you think about how the other versions of yourself would react to this and pay attention to them, then suddenly that sometimes that can nudge you to pay a little bit less attention to the experiencing self.
Boy, that is just a master key for life right there. Wow.
Yeah. You know, paying attention to how you feel right now is not actually the best way to go through life because, you know, our physical bodies are not always happy to move. But then you'll never do anything. You'll do only effortless fun, which is the TV and web surfing. And you won't do the effortful fun, which is getting together with a friend, which is going to the salsa dancing lesson, which is even just like going for a walk with your family. I mean, these are things that they will be great once you've done them, but you have to make yourself do them.
Well, it's interesting in terms of just the anticipating part. You're right in terms of you can draw energy from remembering, hey, that was a cool thing that happened. Yeah. I'm glad I did that. As well as there's a cool thing that's happening soon. I'm looking forward to that. And so then it's sort of even making the present experiencing self a little bit more fueled to begin going there. I'm sort of visualizing just a very beautiful virtuous cycle or vicious cycle in terms of whether you start to build in some great stuff versus you are just always sort of devoid of great stuff and doing the low effort fun.
Yeah, because it's the effortful fun that we really have the memories of. I mean, it's the difference between looking at photos on Instagram of other people's dinner parties or having your own dinner party. They are both ways you can spend your leisure time. One obviously takes a lot more effort than the other, but one is going to be a lot more fun than the other. One will make you, you know, very, very happy, will create great memories. You could look forward to it. You can remember it afterwards. You will enjoy it a lot at the moment, but you also have to invite the people and get the food to your house. And, you know, that takes effort, but effortful fun tends to be the fun we remember.
Well, can you tell us about some of these other practices, such as lingering?
Lingering is about being able to stretch the present. And it's not about, you know, enjoy every minute. Like you can't enjoy every minute. There are plenty of minutes in life are just not actually enjoyable. But you can choose to enjoy the enjoyable ones more and to sort of linger in their happening and thus stretch the experience of time. Part of that is about the anticipating and remembering of it. If you plan stuff in ahead of time that you know will be enjoyable, you can look forward to it, and that kind of makes it bigger in your mind. You can also attempt to be fully present during the experience itself. You can note that you're having fun. There's a certain mental thing. It's not enough just to have fun. You want to be aware that you're having fun. And you can tell other people that you're enjoying yourself. You can make sure you're remembering details. And then after the fact, you can tell people about your fun, or, you know, journal about it or whatever you want to do. Look through old photos, because that makes the memory come back, and then you experience the pleasure a second time. So all of these things can make any given unit of time seem more vast by making it more memorable.
Well, it's interesting as you sort of unpack this, it seems like maybe one easy way to get started and have your cake and eat it too could just be looking at some of your photos. Like, you don't even have to change out of your pajamas to do that. And then in looking at those, it brings back memory like, oh yeah, that was really cool. And then is also provides a bit of a nudge and inspiration for, you know, hey, I should do some more of this stuff. And it kind of gets the train in motion.
It does. And, you know, people talk about dwelling in the past as being a negative thing. And I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, this is how we create our stories of who we are. There's a big part of our identity is what our past is. And we can nurture this relationship with the past as well to make it more of this living thing that helps us through the present, as opposed to something that's kind of just buried in a dusty drawer somewhere.
Well, that's really cool. Well, I also wanted to get your take on people on a plane who are doing Facebook. How does that rub you?
Well, you know, you do you, right? it's one of those. I mean, if you're traveling, probably most of the people on the plane in the middle of the week are traveling for work. Like, these are busy people, right? They got a lot going on in their lives. They're probably the kind of people who are saying, oh, I never have time for XYZ. I don't have time to read. I don't have time to think. I don't have time to relax. I don't have time to take a nap. Well, the plane provides opportunities for all these things. I mean, you're there for 3 hours. It's relatively quiet, or, you know, so, you know, can be if you put your headphones on. And there's generally very few distractions if you don't choose to then, you know, get the Wi-Fi and start checking Facebook. So it's a great time for that kind of focused work that people say they never get a chance for. Or, you know, if you're not comfortable working on the plane for whatever reason, it's a great time to read. You can, you know, make it through a great book in the 3 hours you're in the air. So using this time intentionally, as opposed to just using it for the same thing that people use their bits of time for the rest of their lives, is a great way to actually feel like you have more time.
Well, you have a great line, and I don't know if it's an original or if you're quoting a third party here. You say the fear of boredom is a culprit of waste of time.
Yeah. The original impetus for that came from a great novel. I read Edith Wharton. She's best known for The Age of Innocence, or Ethan Frome. But she has a book that most people, I guess, haven't read because it went out of print at some point, but it's called Twilight Sleep. And the heroine of this book is this bustling, productive woman. I mean, this is 1920, so it's a different sort of productivity than we think of now. But she is basically terrified of having an empty hour. And she will fill it with whatever she possibly can just to avoid the sense of having to think of everything. And I think that happens for us too. Like, if you think about why you reach for your phone when you've got a few minutes, I mean, you could tell yourself, oh, look at me, I'm being productive, I'm deleting email. But like, yeah, there's nothing coming in you really need to delete at this moment. Like, especially if you looked at it 10 minutes ago. Like, it's not, there's nothing there. It's just that we don't actually want to sit there and be bored. And that's fine. But there's other things you can do with little bits of time that might be more meaningful or enjoyable and help you feel like you actually do have more time than when you have leisure time and you chop it up into these tiny bits through checking the phone.
I want to talk about the tiny bits in the phone piece, because you successfully read the entire book, War and Peace, I understand, primarily using the Kindle app on your phone. Is this true?
That is true.
No, that's wild, you know, in terms of, because when...
There are people who are going to tell me, like, my eyesight's got to be going from doing that, but it was little bits here and there.
Well, because I guess that's sort of, we talk about the energy piece. I think sometimes when I it just even conceiving reading War and Peace sounds huge, epic, massive. And then taking a moment to read some, I guess my brain goes to this place, and it's probably false, so set me straight here. It's like, oh boy, War and Peace, that's pretty intense. That's going to really require a whole lot of cognitive capability from me. Got to bring some good, smart energy. And I probably can't do this in like a 3-minute bit to make tiny bites of progress to finish it, because I got to remember where we were before and sort of get into the scene and the characters and the picture that's being painted and the themes and all that. So how do you think about, to what extent is it really manageable and doable to chop up something into tiny bits and to have that work out for you?
Well, I mean, the great thing about Tolstoy is he does it for you. So people think of War and Peace as being this huge, intense, long novel, and it is very long, but the chapters are actually very short. If you look at the print book, most of the chapters are 2 to 3 pages. So in fact, it's a book that lends itself incredibly well to reading on, say, the Kindle app in 5-minute spurts while you are waiting for a phone call to start, while you are waiting for a bus, while you're waiting for your kid at soccer practice or whatever, because these chapters are literally 5-minute reading material. There are a lot of them, but they are very, very short, which, you know, it's one of the ways that Tolstoy keeps the story moving along. But he's a very good writer. There's a reason this book is still around, as opposed to it being, you know, disappeared into the ash heap of history, as they say. So, you know, first I would say it's not as intimidating as it might sound. You could read it in those 5-minute chunks. But if it's not War and Peace, like, you could read a poem in 5 minutes, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's a unit of itself. So load a book of poems on your Kindle and then read one when you've got 5 minutes. And, you know, if you like it, read it again the next time you open it. Or, you know, if you weren't so cool on it, move to the next one. But using those little chunks of time for reading poetry, as opposed to deleting J.Crew ads that have been emailed to you, like, just feels entirely different.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Tell me more about how you would articulate the distinction in terms of J.Crew deletion versus reading poem.
Well, one is really doing nothing for you, I guess is the best way to say it. Deleting email feels incredibly productive. I know it, and the reason is that, you know, what gets measured gets done. And who knows if we made progress on our most important personal and professional goals today, but I know for sure that I got down from 150 unread messages to 75. So, like, yay, go me, right? Whereas many other things do not lend themselves so easily to numbers, and so it's harder to necessarily feel productive doing them. But, you know, poetry takes the brain to great places. It's, you know, how we can see things that we wouldn't have brought our minds to before, great emotions, ideas in history or that real people have gone through, or memories that can evoke memories if we have something similar to what it's getting at, or, you know, just taking the brain into a completely different and higher level than making sure the inbox goes from 150 down to 75. And, you know, if you want to view it in terms of productivity, I don't know if poetry lends itself to productivity, but I do know that giving our brains space to think about bigger things is often where we start to get good ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And that notion that there's a theme associated with those who have high time perception is that they are doing things that were kind of unique and broke up the monotony. And a poem, I think that's very clever, is that that's a short way that goes about breaking up that monotony. And so one thing I do, it's kind of weird, but I don't care. I love it. is I will take a short break and sort of go to my backyard and jump on a trampoline for just a couple minutes. And that's kind of like the opposite of, you know, being at a computer in terms of I'm standing, I'm bouncing, I am outdoors, and it's very quick. And sure enough, there's something to that notion of doing something that is just the opposite or very much different on multiple dimensions than the baseline.
That's a great idea. I mean, one of the things I talk about people should do is planning in breaks during their days in order to manage their energy. I mean, what happens is people are like, oh, look at me, I'm working all hard, I'm working through lunch, look how productive I'm being. And then, you know, around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they're reading the same email 6 times in a row and then falling down some sort of internet rabbit hole because their brain needs a break and they're not taking one. And so the brain forces the issue. Whereas your trampoline break, like, hits on all sorts of different dimensions. I mean, A, you're outside. So getting fresh air adds to most people's energy levels. You're getting physical activity, another thing that adds to most people's energy levels. So, you know, this is a great way to just whatever you were depleted from before to recharge yourself so you can get right back to work.
You had a nice turn of phrase about we're often in denial about taking a break. What does that look like in practice and how can we break better?
Well, if you think about most of these social media breaks that people take during the day, a lot of those are kind of these fake breaks that you think you're still being productive because look at me, I'm still sitting at my computer, right? Like if somebody walked by, it looks like I'm still working, but no, you are not. I mean, you're on whatever thing, you're reading headlines that are not remotely associated with your job. It's just, you need a break from whatever it was you were doing. And so you go over and do this other thing that is sort of effortlessly pleasurable and is a break. But then you don't consider it a break. And it's not actually all that rejuvenating either. Like it doesn't necessarily add to your energy levels to read headlines. I mean, often it takes from it if it makes you stressed out about whatever is going on in the world. So, you know, better to take a real break, to go jump on your trampoline if that's what you do, or go read for 5 minutes, read something real away from your screen, or go outside or have a cup of tea or whatever it is. But, you know, go talk to a work friend whose company you really enjoy. Do something that is a true break, because then you will be able to come back to work restored. The fake breaks just don't do that. And so then we're still dealing with the low energy levels afterwards.
And do you have a personal take on work time versus break time, the right to rhythm, intervals, flow, ratio there?
I don't know. I mean, you know, there's been various studies and people trot out in the productivity world have been trying to find what it is. I would assume most people couldn't go more than 90 minutes before taking some sort of break. And in many cases, it's probably less if it's more intense type of work. You know, you can kind of make yourself do it to a degree by like drinking a lot of water and you have to get up and refill your bottle or go to the bathroom or something. Those are all ways to kind of force yourself to get up and stand. But, you know, I think it's less time than you might think. Like if you're trying to work straight through in the afternoon, like, you know, 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, probably you're not being as efficient as you would be if you put a break somewhere in the middle of that.
Well, and I want to make sure before we kind of shift gears to your favorite things, that this time diaries approach, I think that it's easy to start to do and fail if you're trying to take an honest account and inventory of how you're spending your time. So what are your pro tips, best practices for executing this well?
Yeah, so I'm a bit of a time management freak. I've actually been tracking my time for more than 3 years continuously now, which nobody else needs to do, I'll put out there. But I do think it's good to track your time for a week to see where it really goes. I use just a spreadsheet that's got the days of the week along the top. It's got half hour blocks along the left going from 5 a.m. to 5 a.m. So if you think about the week, it's 5 a.m. Monday to 5 a.m. Monday in half hour blocks. And I try not to be perfectionist about it. Like I just check in, you know, 3-4 times a day and write down what I was doing since the last time. And it's okay to just put stuff like work, hang out with kids, eat dinner, drive to store, sleep, read. The goal is not being so granular that you get like every bathroom trip every time you went to the kitchen for whatever. It's more that you broadly see where the time goes. And just doing that, even with those sort of fairly broad categories, it can still be enlightening. I know in my case, I was spending a lot more time in the car than I thought I was, because I usually work out of my home office when I'm not traveling for speeches or things like that. And so I don't have a daily commute. And so time in the car wasn't really registering to me as a category of my time. And yet when I looked at my time logs, it was a pretty big category of my time. And so that's good to know, because I was just listening to the radio and I don't even really like top 40 radio, but that was what was on. And so I really needed to think about how I can spend that time better.
Mm-hmm. So with this spreadsheet, is it just kind of in the background, you just click open the window from time to time on your computer, or you print it out and write in it, color coding, highlighters, how's it go down?
Yeah, there's no color coding. It's on my computer, on my laptop, and my laptop does tend to travel with me, so it's not something where it's ever gone very far. And because I have the home office, it's there on the weekend too, so I can just stop in and write it down. For different people, you might want to do different things. time tracking apps might be useful for people who don't have a situation where a laptop is very accessible to them big chunks of the time. You can just use a notebook too. I mean, you know, if you want to write down during the week what you're doing on your work computer, and then on the weekend, sort of write it down in a notebook and fill in the log when you come back on Monday, for instance, that would be a good sort of compromise between those things. So, you know, it's really what works for you, and don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I get people, you know, sending me these time logs that are like, you know, in 15 minutes, and they've color coded everything in order to have certain categories that they want to be mutually exclusive and comprehensively exhaustive. And it's like, you know, you don't have to do that.
Well, it's so funny when you say me see. I mean, I am a former strategy consultant, yeah. And you're talking about a spreadsheet.
I'm glad you got that.
And so I am thinking, okay, once I've collected the data, how do I go about working with it? I don't
you
imagine
don't actually have
pivot
to produce
table.
The pie chart. Okay, like you don't actually have to produce the pie chart, which means that your categories don't actually have to be the me see acronym. It's fine just to say this is the amount of time I spend in the car. Maybe this is the amount of time I spent watching TV, or this is the amount of time I spent reading. And if there's a big chunk of multitask time, that's okay. Like, it's just good to know that too. You don't necessarily have to try to categorize it per se.
Very good. Well, Laura, tell me, anything else you really want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and hear about some of your favorite things?
No, I think we've covered a lot of it. It was great.
Cool. All right. Well, then can you share with us a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
Well, you know, I actually put a ton of quotes in off the clock just at the start of every chapter. But one of my favorites was at the absolute start, the introduction, or Mary Oliver, who is a poet. Most people know her line of like, what do you want to do with your one wild and precious life? I'm misquoting that. So that's not my quote. But she has, in one of her poems, she has this line, I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I really like that. That time is something we can maybe think about as an artist might use her materials, as opposed to this kind of steady drumbeat marching toward doom, right? So having this sense of it as an idea you can kind of play around with is a lot more positive and implies that you can do a lot more with it.
Well, yeah, and the notion of an artist and materials is delightful. It just makes you think, what shall I create here? And it has a whole different feel. So yes, thank you. And how about a favorite study or experiment or a bit of research?
So one that I find myself citing over and over again was done by, you know, Daniel Kahneman and Alan Krueger and a bunch of other people who are sort of known in the field of like behavioral science and things like that. But they actually had people track through the day how happy they were as they were doing different things. And so it was a study of like 900 Texas women as they went about a day, and they would report, you know, if they were happy, if they were unhappy, you know, what they were feeling at the time. And so you can see like just this hierarchy of human happiness. And as it turns out, commuting to work is the low point of people's day.
Oh, but not if they listen to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Well, that's why you got to listen to podcasts, because anything you can do to take a minute that would be in this absolutely unenjoyable category at the bottom of human happiness and move it into something that's actually more enjoyable. Well, like that's a huge happiness boost right there. So yes, listen to your podcasts, listen to great music, and you'll feel like you have more time.
Perfect. Thank you. And how about a favorite book?
Oh, I have too many to really say. I would say that the one I have reread probably the most frequently is Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. It's a short novel. It's very lyrical. It's just beautifully written. And I've enjoyed reading it over and over again and find something new every time. It's one of those novels that can be reread, and you see new things every time.
All right. And how about a favorite habit?
So I am one of those crazy people who runs every single day. And I've been doing that since December 24, 2016. I have run at least a mile a day. So that's a little over 500 days now. And yeah, it's a mile isn't that much. So it usually doesn't take me more than like 10 minutes. And so it's pretty hard to tell myself I can't find 10 minutes to exercise somewhere in my day. But usually by the time I've done the first mile, I'm happy to keep going. So it's been good in getting me to run more and thinking more strategically about when I might exercise. Because if you know you need to run the mile a day, the question is not, am I going to exercise? It's when am I going to exercise? And then that's just about problem solving as opposed to motivation.
Well, and I'm curious, what was it about that Christmas Eve that made you say, today I run?
Today I run and I will not stop. You know, it was nothing. It was more that I ran that day, and then we were, you know, I was off work. Like, we weren't traveling anywhere that particular vacation. So I wound up running, I think, 7 days in a row. And then I was like, oh, well, I wonder if I just kept going, you know, what if I continued it? And so this around New Year's as well. And, you know, people often have these New Year's resolutions. And I thought, well, I'll just try it for a while, see if I can run 30 days straight. And then I was like, well, let me see if I run 60 days straight. And by the time you've run 60 days straight, you've pretty much worked it into your life.
And Laura, is there a particular nugget or piece that you share that really seems to connect, to resonate, to get retweeted when you convey it?
Well, one of my favorite thoughts for people is, anytime you're going to say, I don't have time, substitute the language, it's not a priority, because, you know, that's probably actually more accurate. I mean, whatever it is, you're saying, like, I don't have time to iron my sheets. But like, if somebody offered to pay you $100,000 to iron your sheets, like, you'd do it. It would go up the priority list very quickly. So it's not about lacking time. It's that you don't want to do it. And, you know, you may not necessarily want to tell other people that, you know, whatever it is that they're asking you to do is just not a priority.
Your wedding's not a priority.
Your wedding is not a priority. But if it's true, it's true. Like, own this truth about your desires in life and how you wish to spend your time. Because using this language puts us back in control of it. You know, it's not the universe keeping us down. We actually do have many choices. You know, even if life is in many constrained circumstances, there's often at least choices with small bits of time. And once we can start to see that, then often we can expand that sphere of influence over time.
Okay. And Laura, if folks want to get in touch or learn more, where would you point them?
Well, you can come visit my website, which is lauravanderkam.com. And I hope some of your listeners will check out some of my time management books as well. The new one, Off the Clock, is just out, but there are a few others. So if you're looking for more time management titles, there's a shelf full. I can hopefully help you rethink how you spend your time.
And do you have a final challenge or call to action for folks seeking to be awesome at their jobs?
I think that being intentional about how you spend your time is really the most important time management tip. Don't show up at work without having thought through, you know, what would make this an awesome day? And that doesn't necessarily mean you will inevitably do that thing that will make it an awesome day. I mean, stuff does come up, but at least having an idea of why this day will be special and memorable and amazing for you can help you be awesome at your job.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for sharing this good stuff. It's eye-opening. It's powerful. I wish you and Off the Clock tons of luck and success and sales and all that good stuff.
Thank you so much.
I really loved Laura's take on the three selves oh so much, and how the present self is a sort of spoiled child and taking control. And you have sort of a ready-made response. And you're like, oh, I should go dancing. I should go work out. I should go meet up with a friend. But oh, I'm so tired. I don't know if I even can. You can note, well, hey, my future self will appreciate me for this. I'll have some energy liberated from this, and I'll be more likely and more able to do more good energizing stuff, which I can reinvest all over again to get into a real nice virtuous cycle. So I found that inspiring. I hope it equips you in those moments of, oh, I don't feel like it, to dig in and do some of that stuff that will be meaningful and rejuvenating and recharging, so you can make the most of your life and your work and be all the more energized and productive and grand. So good. So again, if you want to check out the show notes or the transcript or the links to items we referenced, it's at awesomeatyourjob.com/F314. If you haven't already, I hope you'll push the subscribe button. You'll hear from Alan Willett making a return appearance. And Alan is talking about leading with speed, how it's done, how to accelerate decision-making, and more. Hope to catch you there, and peace.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. To get the most out of this conversation, visit awesomeatyourjob.com to find today's show notes, transcript, and infographic summary cheat sheet. For more entertaining professional skill sharpening, be sure to subscribe to catch the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.